This is a Miskatonic University special report.
Hello, and welcome to the Miskatonic University podcast. This is a special episode interview with Strix, who is one of the creators behind Bluebeard's Bride. This is a role-playing game that's currently kickstarting, and it's described as Bluebeard's Bride is a horror tabletop RPG where you play aspects of the bride's psyche investigating your husband's haunted manor. Welcome, Strix.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here tonight.
Thanks for having us or talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I think that's the way it goes.
Yeah, it is.
That's the way I'm
That's the one.
I got all like... flustered.
Yep.
Yeah, screw
well
it.
Done. So this Kickstarter is doing really well so far. We're probably releasing this about a week from now, but at this point we are clocking in at more than 57,000 with another 27 days to go.
Yeah, it's kind of blowing my mind, to be honest. You know, we launched this Kickstarter less than a week ago. Our minimum pledge amount was $5,000. When we sat down to really strategize about how this was going to go, we were thinking, honestly, I was thinking, maybe 25 to 30,000 was what we might get out of this Kickstarter. And the first 24 hours, it got $27,000. And I actually went into shock. I was sitting at work and my fingers went numb. And I was like, huh, I think I might be in shock. I don't know what's happening. I should stay seated.
Yeah.
What did you guys do in the lead up to this Kickstarter to get that much attention from an indie title that, I mean, you're basically unknown, to get 27 grand in 24 hours?
So that's an interesting question, and I probably only have part of the answer. So one of the answers is that I and my two co-designers, Marissa Kelly and Sarah Richardson, are very active in the indie design community. So I don't know if you guys know this, but on Google+, of all places, is basically where all of the indie tabletop designers hang out and talk about game design. And there are about 1,000, 2,000 of us. It's a very tight-knit community, and we're just constantly iterating and talking and philosophizing about games. And so everyone kind of knows what's going on with everyone else. So 2.5 years ago, when we first started developing this game, everybody already knew about it, and they were already excited about it. We did major play tests for more than 1.5 years, maybe 2 years, across the U.S., at different conventions, and we let other people tell us what they thought, where the weak points were, and then we iterated on it. And we did this all very publicly. This was not something that was designed behind a closed door as we huddled over a desk and like hissed at people who came near us. This was a very open design process, actually, which I think helped. The third thing is that this game is a feminine horror game, meaning it's about the experience of the horrific from a feminine point of view. And this is a genre that exists in other parts of our media that is very well received. So Rosemary's Baby, Crimson Peak, those kinds of movies, books like Angela Carter's Bloody Chamber, very, very well-lauded pieces. We have, to date, nothing like that in the tabletop scene. There is literally not a game that exists that is a part of this genre yet until Bluebeard's Bride. Mm-hmm. So I think we were filling a huge gap that many people have interest in. And there was nothing to play. And then the fourth thing is that we're working very hard behind the scenes to leverage exposure for this game. So I work in video games as well. I'm a writer and a narrative designer. So I've worked on games for the Xbox. I also work for other tabletop publishers like Onyx Path. I'm on the Scion Project, which actually just finished its Kickstarter. And so as a community member, I've done a lot of things for a lot of people over the years. I'm a diversity and inclusion advocate, so I do a lot of work to make gaming awesome for everyone. So this was when I kind of like, you know, tapped and sort of like, okay, guys, I'm putting in my chips. Like, now is the time to pay me back.
Nice.
So please spread the word about this game. Because, you know, I've written for a lot of games over the years, but this is really the first one that is mine and Sarah's and Marissa's, and that makes it very special to me. And so I kind of put the full force of my shadow Illuminati cohort behind making the game successful.
that's a great way to use those connections.
Definitely. It's good to cash in. I wanted to ask about the story, because I think for people who might be interested in playing and checking this out, that the actual Bluebeard's Bride story, which has, you know, hundreds, dozens, if not hundreds of iterations across time.
Mm-hmm.
What drew you to the story? And could you give us a kind of nutshell for that story? So for context?
Absolutely. So I actually have a master's degree in mythological studies, which means I am kind of an expert on fairy tales. And
awesome.
The fairy tale of Bluebeard in particular is very resonant and very sticky. It's very a popular tale, and it's a very horrific one. So it was first written down by a man named Pernet. He was French. It was in the 1700s. But the fairy tale obviously existed for a long time before that. And as you mentioned, every fairy tale has many, many variants, and there's no one true right version of a fairy tale. But the essentials of Bluebeard is basically he's an aristocrat, and he literally has a blue beard. It's not explained ever. But he has a propensity to kind of like marry a woman, and then she disappears, and he marries another woman, and she gets sick and goes away, and he marries another woman, you know, ad infinitum. And so the story itself centers on one of his many wives, sort of in the middle of this spree. And she marries him, and he, you know, showers her with riches and, you know, lets her have whatever she wants. But he says, hey, by the way, you know, your domain is this household, but there is a room that you cannot go in ever or else. And then he gives her the keys and says, oh, by the way, I've got to go on a business trip. See you in 6 weeks. And it's very obviously a psychological trap, right? He purposely plants this sort of barb in her mind and then goes away to let her sort of dangle on the hook. So she dangles on the hook for a while, and then finally she gives in and she goes to look at what could possibly be in this room that he doesn't want me to see. I'm his wife. I should know everything. What is this? And she opens the door, and in the room she finds all of the bodies of his previous wives, because he's a creeper and he collects them in his little special room. And so she freaks out and drops the keys in blood, and the blood magically sticks to the keys. And that's, you know, a metaphor for the fact that she now knows how evil he is. And of course, that's right when he comes home early from his business trip. And he's like, you know, my wife, where are you? And she's like, oh my God, I've married to this killer. And she tries to hide from him. And this is where the variants really break down into many different patterns. Probably the most famous version is that eventually she is rescued by her two brothers. They ride in on horses and save her from the evil Bluebeard. But the actual variant that we focus on for the game is the one in which he cuts off her head and sticks her in the room, and that's the end.
Sweet.
Ah, the cheerful one. Okay.
The cheerful one. That's right.
Okay.
This sounds like it's just ripe for a Disney adaptation.
I don't see right. Disney ever touching this one, to be frank.
Well, they could, I don't know. Beauty and the Beast is, you know, somewhere in that zone, I guess, as far as creeperness and a parable.
That's
of,
true. And, yeah. You know, Snow White is pretty terrible as well.
Right. It was a grim as well, wasn't it? I mean, this was a grim fairy tale or included in their book at some point or another.
It was included, yeah.
I think it might have been collected in Grimm's. Grimm's was mostly Germanic in origin, so I would have to check.
Yeah, I my notes say Grimm is. It's there's a Grimm version. There's a Dickens version. There's a Margaret Atwood version.
No, it was in Grimm's. It was in Grimm's as well, actually.
Oh, did you just look it up?
Yeah, I just. There's a Bartok opera. I had no
idea
that was
there. There's a bunch of French movies based off of this fairy tale. There's, you know, a lot of derivative works actually in American horror. But in Europe especially, it got a lot of play in the 1920s for whatever reason, 30s.
Interesting.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I had no idea.
I'm completely unfamiliar with this particular story.
A lot of people think it's a pirate. I don't know why.
Well, Bluebeard sounds like a pirate. So.
I think they confuse him with Blackbeard, but Bluebeard has always been this aristocratic, evil wife murderer.
Okay.
The story reminds me a little bit of that Gothic movie that came out earlier this year, Crimson Peak, as well, where it's...
Yeah. So Crimson Peak is actually, a derivative of Angela Carter's Bloody Chamber, which I mentioned earlier. And right. That is a derivative, actually, of Bluebeard. So it all kind of comes around in a circle.
There we go. I knew we'd get there sooner or later, right? So can you explain a little bit more about the system involved in playing the game? Since
Absolutely.
You're all playing, everyone's playing an actual separate part of the psyche in this particular wife of Bluebeard's. Can you, and there's a set number, like there's a hard number on how many people can play, right?
Yes, there is. So my first question to you folks and your listeners is, are you familiar with Powered by the Apocalypse?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. The Apocalypse
Myself,
World
no.
Engine.
So, I've heard of it, but I've not experienced it.
Got it. So
it is
there is this
awesome.
Guy named Vincent Baker, and Vincent Baker made this game called Apocalypse World, and he invented a new dice system to go with it. As it turns out, the Apocalypse World dice system is really flexible and can be adapted into all kinds of different things that have nothing to do with Apocalypse World. So as a starting place for Bluebeard's Bride, we actually asked Vincent if it was okay and used the Apocalypse World mechanics to sort of form the basis of what we're going after. We ended up adding some diceless moves and really changing things around. So it doesn't really look a whole lot like Apocalypse World, but that is sort of the skeleton on which a lot of our stuff is built. So when you're playing Bluebeard's Bride, there are up to 5 different characters you can choose from. And these are similar to Apocalypse World playbooks. And so these are, you know, the mother, the virgin, the animus, the femme fatale, and the witch. And the way to think about these characters is that they're sort of archetypal in nature. They're aspects of the bride's mind, like any of us would have aspects of our own mind. And they're semi-autonomous, and they can do different things, and they can agree, and they can disagree, you know, like having an argument with yourself in your head. But ultimately, they either have to work together or completely destroy each other, because that's also an option, trying to figure out what's going on with Bluebeard. And so the game is for 3 to 5 players. I think you can technically play with 2, and it would still work just fine. But our recommendation is 3 to 5. And it's a one-shot game with high replayability, which means there's one arc. It usually takes 4 to 6 hours to play. And then if you reset everything and you choose different playbooks, or you even choose different moves within the playbooks, you'll have a remarkably different experience the next time that you play it. So when we are thinking about how do 5 people, you know, play one person, play a bride, this is really where my graduate school work came into play with mythology, because I specialized in depth psychology, which is Jungian depth psychology, and he loves archetypes. And he linked them very closely with mythology. And so it was actually a very natural step for me to go, hey, you know what? What if we break down the bride into very distinct personalities, distinct parts of her personality and mind, and have the player play those.
And the different parts of her will kind of war with each other and as in her decision-making process to whether or not to look at that one room or to investigate somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing.
So the way that the game works is that there is a number of tokens that you can collect. And there are distinct types. There's 2 types. So one are tokens of faithfulness, and the other are tokens of loyalty. And the way that you get these tokens is you go into one of these rooms in Bluebeard's mansion and you investigate. And you will pick a token. It could be, you know, a broken pair of glasses or a book with an inscription or a bloody pair of scissors. And then it is actually up to you, the players, not the GM, to decide whether this token indicates that Bluebeard really loves you and he's a nice guy, or he's a scary bad person and you should run away. The hook here is that there are many terrible things in this mansion that hurt you. They give you what we call trauma points. And if you get enough trauma points, you shatter and you die. And then you haunt the rest of the sisters that are left, these other archetypes. So it's no good.
Oh, I love that structure. That's cool.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. You can choose what your token is like, right? It's either a token of faithfulness or a token of disloyalty. The only way, well, one of the only ways to heal trauma is to take a token of loyalty.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Loyalty to Bluebeard?
Yep.
Oh, weird.
Oh, so the only way that you can heal is to buy into his own story.
Is to buy into the idea that everything's okay. Actually,
yeah,
it's okay.
Everything's fine.
It's fine.
Crazy.
That is awesome. Wow. That is an awesome parable and mechanic for domestic violence and codependency. Well done.
It is pretty deep cutting, I have to
say. Yeah. That is dark as hell.
At the same time, though, when one of these aspects of the personality or one of the players goes dark or mm-hmm. is obliterated,
shatters.
That's also one step closer to being just straight up insanity. Is that also correct, or am I losing?
That is something? Correct. So if all of the sisters shatter, which is possible in the game, then there is an outcome, an ending that is triggered. And basically, yes, the bride goes insane and totally loses her grip on reality, and then essentially becomes one of the ghosts or the haunting things in the mansion for the next set of players to go and investigate.
Oh, interesting. So what happens whenever a player's character or aspect is shattered? What is that player's role from then on?
Mm-hmm. So it's actually pretty neat. They have basically the reverse of their character sheet. They flip it over. And then there is a verse which they have to ritualistically chant.
Oh, God.
And it's very disturbing. But
you mean the whole time I've died, I've shattered.
Uh-huh. Yep.
I now have to flip over my character sheet and just chant the entire time.
Not the entire time. You only have to do the chant once.
Okay.
But each time a sister shatters, everyone who is shattered does the same chant again. So it's a ritual. And then these shattered sisters take opportunities to basically act as a phantom or a ghost or something else that is haunting and terrible and attack what is left of the bride.
Wow.
How do they actually do that, though? What is the mechanic for attacking another's aspect of yourself?
So basically, they assist the groundskeeper, the GM, in deciding what kind of horrible thing is going to happen to the bride next. So the GM still has control, and that's important. But they have influence over the particular pain points that they want to push on to freak the bride out.
Do they get the same sort of splat? I forget what they're called, the splat powers or the moves. They get the same moves as they had before?
Nope, they don't have the same moves as they had before.
That's done. I see. Yeah.
Yeah. They have distinctly less power and agency, which is necessary because we found out that once people flip over to shattered, they just turn crazy and want to really horrify everyone else.
Yeah, man. I can see that happening for sure. that script thing, have you ever played Road to Lindisfarne? The sort of witch lynching story. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, sorry. Have you played? Do you recognize that Road to Lindisfarne, where you read scripts at the end of a long journey, escorting a witch to her death? No.
No, actually, I have not. But now I want to look into it. It sounds very interesting.
Well, what I was going to say is that script reading can be devastating, and it certainly was in the game that I played at a convention. It is. Really, there's something about it, something about reading scripts ritualistically that is pretty mm-hmm. powerful. So I appreciate you using that tool. I thought that's might be, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely up there on the creepy meter.
Exactly.
For the record, I think that's called Witch. Wasn't that called Witch, : the Road to Lindisfarne?
Sure. Yep.
Yeah, I think that's what you're...
Oh, I know of Witch. I know people who've played Witch and have had a really great time with it.
Yeah, that's
so,
a great...
I do know that game. I just haven't played it.
It's devastating. Choose the right night.
Got it.
But I think this one would be too, in a really, really great way. I mean, it's it sounds like the kind of... you sort of have to pull your resources together and face this story, I think, in a pretty... Have to come at it with some strength, I guess.
So with it being the same script over and over and over again that you end up playing, mm-hmm. what are the differences that the GM can put in that varies it between each session?
Sure. So that's a great question. The way that the generation of content works is that while you're exploring these rooms, there's not a set map. There's not a set book where you just pick a room and you read out loud what's in there. The way that it works is that the GM, the groundskeeper, will have one aspect of the bride. It's usually whoever is holding the wedding ring or the ring of subservience, as we call it. She has a little bit of extra power while she's holding the ring. So that particular character, I hear that cackling. I hear that.
Tell us how you really feel.
I think this game is us telling you how we really feel.
Yeah. This is your fiance as well, right?
Yeah, I heard yes, you say that. I am engaged.
Okay. Bring him some trivia. I'm divorced, this so is... I hold no cards in this bit, but it's funny either way.
Yeah.
So the GM has the character who is holding the ring describe the key that they're holding. And we make it so that that description is fantastical. So that key could literally have like a tiny bottle on the knob and with a little ocean inside. Or it could be hot and spill molten lava everywhere. Or it could drip blood or have butterfly wings or really anything you want to think of that would sort of describe a theme or a feeling or a place. We definitely encourage GMs and players both with our materials on how to do that. But the keys are fantastical. And so the player will say, you know, this key is hot to the touch and it's rusty like steel. And then suddenly it goes cold and the teeth are very jagged. And then the GM will go, okay. And they will think to themselves, based on what that is, it sounds like we're talking maybe about a furnace room or a room where they do metalsmithing nice. Or blacksmith work. And so the GM will say, okay, you put in the key, you turn the lock, you open the door, it closes behind you, and this is what you see, right? You see this table with all of these implements on it, and you don't recognize them, but there's a mallet, and there's a screwdriver, and there's this sharp thing that's hooked, and you don't even know what it is. And then from there, you know, the play unfolds and they investigate and they pick some items and bad, terrible, horrible things happen. There's ghosts that get them. There's servants that undermine them. There's a lot of sexual tension, you know, just all kinds of bananas things. But, you know, I've ran this game so many times over the last 2.5 years and I've never described the same room twice. It's always been a remarkably different game. And I think that's one of the strengths of the game is you can have such a rich and ethereal place, and it never gets tired, it never gets old.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, that was my main question on how you actually chose what it was, but you're leaving that agency really up to the players, and then a little bit of interpretation from the GM to try and figure out where they're going next.
Yes, and actually I think that's a deeper key to horror. You know, it's pretty easy as a GM to say, oh, a giant spider, boogly boogly boo, or ooh, look at that dripping blood, isn't that scary? But what really scares people are the things that they're going to tell you about that scare them. So we want players to tell us what is scary, and then our job is to draw out of them, not to throw things at them. We find that to be a much more powerful circle of horror and much more affecting, and so we definitely gear our game towards that kind of horror.
I would so agree with that. And even in the traditional game that we talk about and play, this Call of Cthulhu, we've talked about that technique of throwing it back on players, asking them, how do you express your insanity? This has disturbed you, and you tell me what happens next. What do you picture? Mm-hmm. What is your flashback? You know, those kinds of things can really create dark, awesome, creative opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. Let players scare themselves. They are more than capable of doing it. You just got to get out of their way.
Totally agree. Well, so what is the kind of experience that you're going for? What was your guide star for the, obviously you are talking about, that codependency and the sort of, the ugliness in that story of misogyny and domestic violence, I guess. What are your pillars as far as what you're trying mm-hmm. to get people to experience?
So the game really is not about domestic violence or about analogs to real life situations. Those are mm-hmm. present and they are important. But what the game is really about is sitting with certain kinds of horrors that are not unique to, but align more with a feminine perspective. And that's not saying women, because, you know, many types of people can be feminine and everyone has femininity within them, just like everyone has masculinity within them. But it's about the kind of horror that you cannot escape. Like, there is not a way out. So it's not about winning. It's not about fighting your way to victory or losing. It's not about triumph or lack of triumph, because that's already been spelled out for you. What it's really about is, what do you do with yourself? Who are you when you are hemmed in, when you have no good choices, when every choice that you make hurts you or hurts someone that you love, or how the whole world will wrap itself around you and say, your perspective is wrong. Your view of reality is wrong. You need to adhere to what we're saying. And then it twists you apart. It makes you insane. That's a very deep and uncomfortable feeling. And it is very horrifying. And I think that is what we're after.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like what you described there is cosmic horror, which is kind of what we talk about as well, but in a more emotional, internal sense.
Mm-hmm.
Just the sense that the universe is, when the universe is entirely against you, or that, you know, that there's no care out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying. I think there's one big difference between feminine horror and cosmic horror. And cosmic horror is really about the ineffable. It's about what's out there. It's mm-hmm. about sort of infinitude. Feminine horror is basically about what is inside you.
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, the mansion in Bluebeard's Bride, while it's a terrible, scary place and it's Bluebeard's home, it's also a metaphor for the bride's own mind, right? So it is all about you as a person, your identity, your internal stuff that you have going on. And so I think it's the same kind of horror, but turned inward instead of outward.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very, very, very interesting.
So let's talk about the art. The art in this is fantastic.
Yes.
who is the artist that you have on board that's doing this?
So we actually have several artists working for us. But I think the particular artist you're referring to is the one who is doing our cover work and then the head of every chapter piece. So we have, I think, 5 pieces from her in total. And her name, and I always get her last name wrong and I feel really bad about it, but her name is Rebecca Yanovskaya. There we go. I've got it. Yanovskaya. So Rebecca Yanovskaya is the artist that did the pieces that are most prominently featured on the Kickstarter. And we actually had our eyes on her, us 3 designers, me, Marissa, and Sarah, more than a year ago, actually, while this was still being tested and worked on, because we looked at her work and we're like, you know, my God, this is exactly what we want for Bluebeard. This is exactly the aesthetic, the etherealness, the terrible darkness, but, you know, those highlights of gold that are her her telltale, her handmark. And so we really, really wanted Rebecca. And we were afraid we're not going to get her, but we managed. And I think that it's just a match made in heaven. The artwork is fantastic. It's so evocative and it pairs so well with the kind of story that we're trying to tell that it was really fortunate that we were able to work with her.
Yeah, it's a fantastic pairing. Her artwork and then this particular project, it just goes hand in hand, it seems.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So the majority of what we're seeing so far is just is Rebecca?
Yeah. So the big pieces that you've seen are Rebecca's. Some of the minor splash art, for instance, the sisters, where it has their names plus like body parts, hands and faces.
Yeah.
Those are some of our other artists. And they're also listed on the Kickstarter page. But I actually can't remember off the top of my head which of them did those smaller splash art pieces.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, they certainly blend nicely with the rest of the pieces that are on the page. So
yes, it's all
like
very
all these,
congruent.
The artists, yeah, the artists that you've collected definitely seem to all get the same feel for the style, the art.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Gothic Klimt. You know what I mean? It's the weird gold highlight, but then this fantastical, crazy detailed illustration, pen and ink illustrations, really fantastic.
Yeah, I can't believe she does that with pen. It blows my mind.
Yeah, it's really impressive. I got an all high to hole here. I found her website.
Yeah, her stuff is gorgeous, right?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It really is. I'm gonna have to pick up some of this. Okay. Where were we at? I lost track of all sense of time. Somebody showed me pretty pictures.
One thing that kind of, I was thinking of, just from my point of view on gaming and stuff. Now, whenever you're talking about where in the character that everybody's playing, that she's investigating these rooms and stuff. These are just more of a text description, psychologically imagined sort of thing, right? We're not looking at, like, an actual, like, floor plan to a house here. We're looking at imagined, everyone kind of describing it together sort of thing.
Yes, it's definitely okay. Cooperative narrative. There are no figurines, there's no battle maps. It's all created together in, you know, the liminal space of the imagination.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought. I just wanted to make sure I was clear on it because, you know, I'm looking at the campaign and it was, okay, one of your things that's being added in is the Book of Rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And so that just is describing more of the potential rooms that she could find and explore.
That's right. It's extra scaffolding for GMs and players both to help them build the narrative. You know, some people are not as good as like just thinking kind of right off the top of their heads or digging into things that maybe they don't know a lot about architecture. That's okay. And so we wanted to make sure that no matter who was running the game or playing the game, that they had enough material, enough fictional material to build the kind of awesome things that they want.
Okay.
I did mess awesome. With someone one time. So when I was beta testing the game, someone was like, I'm going to draw a map as we go along. I'm going to draw a map of the mansion so we can keep track of where we are. And I was like, So I ended up moving rooms around on them and it drove them crazy. And they ended up tearing up the map, which I thought was perfect. So nice. Drawing a map in my game is not going to help you very much.
That's great.
That's pretty good. So can you talk about some of the stretch goals? You've unlocked like a whole slew of
At least 15. I'm trying to keep up.
Yeah. So, yeah. But a lot of the stretch goals are actually added on items. You only have the deck of objects and then mm-hmm. the tarot deck of servants and some extra, you know, kitsch little stuff that gets added on. Mm-hmm. So can you go into... Do you think you are going to be able to supply that in a timely order? Just, I'm sure the product is done and written.
Yes.
And probably laid out and everything's done on that. Mm-hmm. It's ready for print, I'm assuming, right?
Yes.
Which is good. But how long do you envision on taking all these extra stretch goals to get added on and fulfilled? Or do you see that as being a problem at all?
Mm-hmm. So this is something that is actually sort of out of my particular wheelhouse. So the three of us, the three designers, signed with a publisher, Magpie Games. And basically we gave Magpie the rights to publish the game, blah, 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 percentages. And so Magpie is running the Kickstarter. We're supporting, obviously, okay. And we're doing all kinds of work, kind of hustling on the side. But Magpie is ultimately the entity responsible for fulfilling everything. Magpie has a pretty good track record as a gaming company. Yeah. They've produced several games before. They're pretty good at running Kickstarters. We've mapped out basically all potential stretch goals. It's not like we're like, oh, and we need to add this thing and oh, we need to add this thing. All of this was thought of way in advance. And so we've priced out, you know, the shipping costs and the production costs. And I'm fairly confident that there are not going to be any big lags here. So as we go along, what I'm most interested in actually is that the Kickstarter goal that we unlocked very recently was the art prints. So originally we were not going to have the funds to do art prints, but now that we have made as much as we've made, we've unlocked this stretch goal where you can now get prints of this amazing art by Rebecca as either 6x6 or 12x12. And then we're also doing play sets. And that's adding a little bit of different flavors to Bluebeard's Bride, kind of out of the box in case you wanted to try a different setting but weren't sure of your footing.
Yeah, I was just looking at that. You just unlocked the Dark Carnival playset. So yeah. Instead of a mansion, you're roaming around in a carnival, and it's the ringmaster instead of the husband.
Mm-hmm. Because if it wasn't terrifying enough, now there are clowns.
Yeah.
Also clowns.
So this book has all the trigger warnings. All of them.
Yes, including all clowns. Of them. Every single one you could think of.
Oh, God. I don't like clowns.
Well, we found your sore spot.
Yeah, we'll move on then. So basically you're relying on Magpie to fulfill your secondary objects that are in the Kickstarter.
That is correct.
Okay, good. That's good.
Leave it to the pros, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's where a lot of indie games tend to fall, is they add on, and even not indie games. I mean, look at our own Kickstarter of our debacle with Call of Cthulhu's 7th edition. You know, they raised crazy amounts of money, and they supplied all these crazy add-ons and extras. The more and more money that they made, and then 3 years later, they haven't been able to produce most of them. Most of them have gone to the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
It was just more than they were willing or able to actually put out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's good that you're not relying on that, and hopefully Magpie doesn't go too crazy. It's all within reasonable bounds.
I really believe so. You know, we did all the math before it even started, and so nothing really should be out of whack.
Good to know.
Something I wanted to make sure that we mentioned before you have to go is that I want to direct listeners to check out your article, Why Minority Settings in RPGs Matter, which I think is sort of required reading if you're interested at all in this conversation that we've been having about race and gender and the setting of the 1920s and how to kind of navigate that, navigate some of the uncomfortable topics that might come up. Can you talk a little bit about defaultism and how this game is possibly a way to poke at defaultism and delve into a minority setting?
Sure, of course. So, So I wrote an article for Tor, that's what he's referencing, about why minority settings in RPGs matter. And they matter to me very much because I am a woman of color, I'm Hispanic, and I'm a girl. And so I am automatically a minority in several different ways. And defaultism in particular is this idea about the status quo and how we sort of just make assumptions, all of us do, you, me, everyone, about what is happening in a setting if it's not defined. And of course, this is painting with a broad brush. Not everyone does this all the time. And if you don't, kudos to you. But what I found was that basically, if you leave your setting undefined, meaning you are talking about New York in the 1920s, and you go into a cafe and you sit down and you say there's a bunch of people in the cafe, there's a guy reading a newspaper, there's a woman drinking her coffee, what color are those people? Well, you probably thought they were white, right? That's probably the first thing that came to your mind. And that is defaultism in a nutshell. It's assuming that when things are undefined, that you mean the status quo. And the status quo in literature and media and movies and just about everything else we consume is that folks are usually white or they're white male. The hero is always a white male, unless it's stated otherwise. That's defaultism. And so that limits us, frankly. It limits what we can imagine. It limits the types of experiences we can have in games. And it definitely alienates people, sometimes like me, who say, huh, I don't see myself here. Maybe this is not for me. And so we want to deconstruct and we want to take down defaultism because I personally think games are really cool. I think a lot of people enjoy playing them. And I want more people to feel welcomed and like they have a place to play games and they have games that speak to them. And so Bluebeard's Bride definitely dismantles defaultism. Because it's specifically about a certain kind of experience, which is mostly experienced by a minority of people. And when I say minority, I mean minority in terms of sociological power, societal power, not sheer numbers. And so for this, it was feminine. It was women. What kind of horrors do women experience? And what is that like? And now we have this amazing game and people are like, man, why haven't we had anything like this before? This is really cool. And I think it really underlines a couple of really important facts. One, it's financially lucrative. Like you're not going to lose money opening up games to folks who maybe are not part of the default set. And two, you get to play really cool stuff that you haven't experienced before. I love Dungeons and Dragons. I play it all the time. But you know, there's only so many times that I want to roll up like an elf or a barbarian or an orc and I want to go be a murder hobo and kill things. I want to do other things too. I can still go be a murder hobo sometimes, but I also want to have other kinds of experiences in games.
Cool.
Okay.
Very cool. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great to have that, you know, stated so clearly because it is just like you phrase it, it's the default mindset. And, you know, I know I'm guilty of it. It's just,
oh, I'm guilty of it all the time, unless I'm consciously aware of it. And then I go, you know what? there are these kinds of people here and there are these kinds of people here. It just takes a little bit of conscious effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also nice to.
Go ahead.
It's nice to have with an indie game like this that really just has, you know, a certain kind of focused, protagonist, because say in Call of Cthulhu or Dungeons and Dragons, I think one tends to just choose what's familiar and, partly because it may be uncomfortable to say, for me to play a woman in a Call of Cthulhu game says something. It's a certain kind of statement, right? That, which doesn't mean that I can't do it, but it one tends toward a default character that is like oneself, for reasons of not wanting to encroach or offend and play something that, you know, maybe somebody else's territory and that you may not be role playing properly. And also, lack of experience, but it is really nice to have a focused, role-playing game where, no, I'm going to play, one of the many parts of a woman's psyche that's going through this. And that's just the game. That's the premise.
So what I heard was it is nice to play these, other people in other settings, but it can make you nervous because you don't want to get it wrong. And I think that's a perfectly natural thing to feel, right? That's totally okay. But from my perspective, as a minority person, I would much rather that you try and maybe I go, hey, maybe not that particular way. And then you try again and get it right, rather than not. My fiance actually sat down at a gaming table once and he's Southeast Asian. He's from India. Well, sorry, his family's from India. He was born in New Jersey. He sat down and he decided that he was going to play an Indian character. And that's perfectly normal because that's who he is. But everyone else around the table were not Indian. And one of the other players asked, you made an Indian character. What kind of statement are you trying to make?
Wow.
And no one would ask that of you making a white guy character, right? So that's another danger of defaultism, is that it can really be alienating for folks who aren't part of the status quo.
Thank you for the opportunity to play a minority character. That's cool.
Got it. You're welcome. I hope that it touches you deeply in all the wrong places, because it is a horror game.
Yeah, it's all bad touch. That's where it's meant to go.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, okay, wait. On defaultism, can you go into a little bit about the Dead Scare and the Tulsa Race Riots?
Oh, God, Greenwood, yes.
And all that.
Oh, man.
Because if you don't, Chad will castrate me later. So
yeah, absolutely. So a little bit, well, a lot of background is required here, actually. So Elsa Henry is making a game called Dead Scare. And I would say it's a feminist horror game, but not a feminine horror game, in that it's about women triumphing in horror scenes where basically everyone's turned into zombies and only women and children are left, and they're fighting their way out of suburbia, essentially. So that's Dead Scare. And Elsa came to me and a few other writers, and she's like, hey, I want you to write a scenario for Dead Scare, but I want you to, you know, do something interesting. And I was like, cool. Well, I'm going to write about women of color, and I'm going to write about something that you're not going to see somewhere else. I'm going to do a minority setting. And that's something that I've been pretty consistent with all of my writing, is that I really want to get into those things. And she's like, cool, what do you want to do? And I was like, okay, here's the thing. I went to undergraduate school at the University of Tulsa, and that is in Oklahoma. And Tulsa was home to the worst, as in underscore the worst, race riot in the history of the United States. And I had been taught about it when I was in high school in California, even as far back as middle school, because I moved to Oklahoma a little bit later before graduating. And I attended university, and there was a subject that came up, you know, in one of my gen ed classes, and I brought up the race riots. And I was like, oh yeah, that thing that happened here that was really terrible. And some of the other students in the classroom were locals. You know, they had grown up in the area and they'd gone to the university. And they're like, what are you talking about? And I was like, what do you mean? What am I talking about? This happened in your city. Well, what happened was basically the Greenwood District of Tulsa, which was a portion of Tulsa that was heavily segregated and was all black, did very well in the 1920s and a little bit earlier. They had their own hospitals. They had their own banks. They even had their own airstrip, and some of them owned airplanes. And basically, the rest of white Tulsa couldn't handle it. And they found an excuse to go burn it down. And they did. And they burned it down, and police officers, you know, were arresting black people as they were being attacked. Their planes were stolen, and they were literally bombed from the air. Like, it's a horrific incident to think about. And it is really unimaginable. It was very terrible. And Greenwood never recovered, actually. I did a study for a sociology class on urban food deserts in Tulsa. And that's when, you know, there's no place to buy groceries within a certain mile span. And the biggest food desert was in the Greenwood District, or what was left of the Greenwood District of Tulsa, because what happened was when they tried to rebuild afterwards, insurance schemes and zoning laws kept them from rebuilding. It was basically an institutional systemic oppression that continued to happen after the riots. And Greenwood never recovered. It's now a very impoverished area. It's a food desert. There's a lot of problems that stem back to this race riot that was never addressed. So it's terrible. The other thing that happened was that it was removed, any mention of it, from newspaper archives, from education materials. It wasn't taught about in the schools. It basically got blackballed. So no one in Tulsa knew what the hell had happened unless they were directly related to the incidents or they happened to be black, because obviously that is not something you can forget when it's perpetrated against you. So this was a terrible thing and no one knew about it. And I was shocked and a little appalled and a little angry. And going back to Dead Scare, I was like, I want to write about Greenwood in the 40s and 50s. This is a thing that has to be done. And this is when they were still recovering from the race riots, but there was still some hope maybe that they might find their purchase again. They might find their footing and recover some of the prosperity that they had. It turns out later we know that really not happened, but there was still that glimmer of hope in the community. And so the gist of it is, the experience of a black woman from Greenwood in the 1950s in this Dead Scare where there are zombies and there are different things going on is going to be very remarkably different from the narrative story and the game being played from another part of Tulsa where maybe there's, you know, there's your stereotypical 1950s housewife who serves steak to her husband and has a chrome toaster. Like, those are almost not equatable. As far as experiences go, they can exist in the same game, but because you're pulling on this minority setting and this minority history, you're going to have something just completely different going on. I just talked a lot, so I'm going to stop.
So cool.
Yeah.
I was wow.
So
yeah, it's
yeah.
Really awesome.
And it's just things like that. I mean, there's so much history. There's so much history that just doesn't get talked about, that isn't explored, that is terrible and moving and awesome and interesting and amazing. And we don't get it because it's sort of sidelined. And I want to see more of that, personally speaking.
I think you're not alone. I think that we
Good.
Do too. Yeah. And I think even in this trad game that we play, it's a sort of historical fiction game. And there are plenty mm-hmm. of opportunities to explore horribleness and poke at some of these unknown history bits in a fun way.
Absolutely. Yeah, that Call of Cthulhu would be especially ripe for that. I mean, it's very much oriented towards the South in some ways, especially with True Detective sort of filtering into the consciousness these days. There's just so many things that you could tap, so many things.
Yeah, we've tried to find more and more of those things to bring up on our own show over the last few years. But, you know, this ripe with choice in mm-hmm. that sense.
It's exciting.
It is.
Yeah. Role-playing games are one of those fascinating things to give you the opportunity to actually put on someone else's shoes for a while
mm-hmm.
and to at least try to get some measure of understanding of a different viewpoint like that. It's, you know, I'm the generic white guy from middle America, so I'm never going to have the experience of somebody who is a different, you know, race or gender. So role-playing games are pretty much it.
Yeah.
It's the closest I'm going to get.
Mm-hmm. It's a great vehicle for directly connecting with that content. Now, you know, you can connect better sometimes if you can connect worse. But it's not like consumption media like movies or plays where you just sit there and you absorb it. You actually are engaging with it, which makes it, I think, a much more powerful experience.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I've been advocating for years to pretty much everybody I know that role-playing games are a really important tool for understanding other people.
Oh, I agree with you so much. We can evangelize together.
Is there anything else, Whitney, that we didn't talk about that you want to bring up?
I guess I would just want to say that I'm really proud of this game. The way that this game got made was kind of remarkable. It almost happened by accident because basically three women who didn't know each other sat down together at a game jam and came up with this game. And then we decided that we were going to do it. And hell or high water could not stop us for 2.5 years. And, you know, I think I've never heard of that happening before, personally. So I'm so glad that this game has seen the light of day. I'm really happy that people are embracing it, that they seem to get what we're tossing out. And hopefully my goal is that many people have amazing experiences with it. And I'm confident in the way that we wrote it and the care that we took with it, that that is more than possible, that it's probable and hopefully easy. And I can't wait to hear actual play reports come back to me from when it's been released into the wild. And so I can just nod my head and go, yeah, we did it.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I hope we can be a contributor to that. I'd like to play this. And I think we should think about that.
I think we should do this.
For sure.
Well, when you do, let me know and tell me how it went. I'm really interested to see how it goes for you guys.
We'll have a 4 or 5 hour audio of it, I'm sure.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, we have the habit of recording anytime that we wind up playing. So, yep. And I just jumped on at the $20 full PDF level. So,
hey-o.
Hey-o.
I'm looking forward to seeing it whenever this gets produced. This is great.
Cool. So for and you, just really quickly, and for anyone else who backs at any level, even if you back for a dollar, the very first update that is backers only has the beta test materials that you can download. It's not the final version, but you, if you know Powered by the Apocalypse, could probably play tonight if you wanted to.
Oh,
I know it.
We've played. Just giving you $20. God bless. Okay.
Awesome.
Guess what we're doing later, Chad.
Excellent.
I love it. I can't wait. This sounds like such a dark ride. I can't wait.
No, I really appreciate you coming and talking to us about this. Yeah, it's going to be really great.
Well, thank you guys so much. This was a great conversation. With the Skype roboting aside, I think we got into some pretty deep discussion here. And, thanks for letting me say my piece.
Oh, absolutely.